money or?
I frankly think in the end, looks in the Democratic race right now like it'll be Bradley and Gore, and it makes sense for anybody who, if they're the second choice, to stay around there because the front runner often trips. Elizabeth Dole is struggling for money, and so on. There are four or five Republican candidates who I think are still somewhat viable, but one of them, Forbes, is likely to hang in there till the last minute for one reason alone, and that's money. His is not raised from special interest. His is his personal money. But nevertheless, money is determining who becomes the candidates. And then money is determining who wins the elections. And I know of one person, I actually met an individual here at Holden Village a number of years ago. He later ran for the Minnesota legislature in a rural district, and we have relatively small districts, and we have some of the better campaign finance limits in the country. He's limited as a state representative to spending, I think it's about $24,000 in a campaign. And he ran an unsuccessful race one time, then a couple years later he was running for a state house seat in the race that his party held in the past and was expected to retain. And he ran a good campaign, hardworking guy, and his opponent didn't do that much until the last 3 weeks. There were radio ads in Twin Cities, WCCO radio, in the race, in races like that. There were postcards, flyers going to every house. There were two or three groups that put in a ton of money. Two of the groups were issue advocacy. They didn't say vote for or vote against. So they weren't even classified as independent expenditures, so we as a public have no way of knowing who funded them, who they are, what they stand for other than their name. One was Coalition for Our Children's Future from Falls Church, Virginia. They had these glossy postcards saying how so-and-so was really good on these things and this guy was really bad on them. Didn't say vote against him or vote for the other guy. You couldn't get any impression other than vote for or against him. Anyway, this candidate, we sort of tried to figure out how much was spent against him in the last 3 weeks, and he figured that these three groups alone spent probably $40,000-$50,000, more than double he was allowed to spend all year. He had no clue this was coming, no way of knowing it was coming, no way to respond to it. He happened to win in a three-way race with by about 0.5% with 45% of the vote, and so he won, so it proves money doesn't always talk. Well, another district, somebody else hit by the same three organizations working, did get beat by a very close margin. And it doesn't take a lot of votes in a lot of districts to make a difference in who controls the political process. And that's the part that determines who gets elected. And I would argue it also determines what issues they may choose to focus on. I think that if you look at issues, somebody last night at the forum raised the issue of affordable health care. I think if you take polls of the public, I've seen some polls, I don't have any with me today to show exactly what it is, but the public saying that they think what I sort of sense was an unwritten and never quite fulfilled social compact that was started in New Deal days about how, you know, you work 40 hours a week, that's full-time work, and you're going to have your retirement set aside for with Social Security. And though it took 40 more years, 20, 30 more years to get health care for retirement, health care for all Americans has never quite been fulfilled. And I think if you ask polls, do you think someone who's working full-time should be able to go see a doctor when they need, should get medical care they need? And they shouldn't be turned away because they don't have money. I think polls usually suggest 60%+ of the public says yes, that is a priority for them. But anybody talking universal health care in state or national elections is considered, that's considered a fringe issue. Why? Because there's nobody funding that sort of thing. There are lots of pressures in the political process funding other things. That doesn't mean they're going to attack the person for, this person believes everybody should have health care, and they want to, if they do, it'll be, they want government-run health care, government mucking around in your health care kind of ads. But there are lots of groups that will attack them just on other issues, wherever they think they're most vulnerable. Why? Because they want to get rid of those people from the political process. So certain issues don't ever quite come to light. People think, boy, everybody I talk to wants, cares about this. Why don't politicians talk about that? Well, it's because the money process talks about who's going to run and what issues they may talk about. The other area where money has an impact is access to politicians after they are elected in office. And they do that two ways. One is through gifts and contributions after they're elected. And the other is just the fact that they already have gained the access from the contributions they made in order to help somebody get elected. You know, when I was first running for office, I wasn't expected to win, and I abided by our voluntary spending limits. They are, by the courts, required to be voluntary. I ran for office, accepted our spending limits, which 12 years ago were about, I think, around $37,000 or so. I spent probably $36,500 of it, and my opponent chose not to abide by the limits, for which he lost several thousand dollars in public money. That was the only consequence. And he spent $55,000 or so, and he knew he was going to win. I pulled off an upset. I outworked him, did several other things right, and I beat him. 3-4 days after I was elected, I started getting all of these nice congratulatory letters, and so I got one from a lobbyist who said, "Dear John, congratulations on your election." I mean, I can recite this 12 years later, almost verbatim, because I saved the letter. It was such a gem. "Congratulations on your election. You showed hard work really does make a difference. One of my clients had the," he named who they were, "had the misfortune of having contributed to your opponent. Here is a contribution to you as they wish to make amends." I saved the letter. Well, what was the misfortune? Did these people not think that this, didn't they give to this guy because they thought he was the best guy for the state or even the best guy for their particular industry? Well, probably not. They gave to him because he was supposed to win. And they goofed. So now they're trying to make amends. Why should they make amends? Because I'm the one who votes on the issue that they care very deeply about, and therefore they want to be on my good side too. And so they want to get access. That's a contribution after an election to try and do it. But Jesse Ventura, our governor, had run saying he wouldn't take PAC or lobbyist money. He did take large individual contributions, which is one of the big routes of big money. But most of the big money didn't go his way because he didn't have a chance again. And so afterwards, it was amazing how many tried to fund things like his inaugural fund in other ways. They were eager to contribute to those things, and lobbyists were in a tizzy. How do we quickly get access to this guy now? We didn't give money to him. And I don't mean to suggest that everybody works solely. So there are lots of lobbyists who don't even make campaign contributions. That's not the way everything works, but it's clearly tilted that way in many ways. And again, it's not a buying of votes, but you know, if somebody gives you $1,000, you might be, one U.S. senator said a couple years ago, you come home at 11:30 at night, and you got a call back to your home, you got a list of calls from your home state, and an hour or two later there, and you know you can return one or two of them. Which ones are you going to do? Well, if there's a big contributor in there, human nature is you will probably include that one on your call list. It certainly moves up the call list when somebody's done something for you. It's in the race, I think. I think they're about five or six.
He is?
I've heard some news about that he's expected to.
One of the nice things about being around here is we don't always know. And one of the bad things about being around here.
Right, my friend before it came out that
he's thinking of dropping out.
Dropping out. I was wondering if it was money or.
I frankly think in the end, it looks in the Democratic race right now like it'll be Bradley and Gore, and it makes sense for anybody who, if they're the second choice, to stay around there because the front runner often trips. Elizabeth Dole is struggling for money, and so on. There are four or five Republican candidates who I think are still somewhat viable, but. One of them, Forbes, is likely to hang in there till the last minute. for one reason alone, and that's money. His is not raised from special interest, his is his personal money, but nevertheless, money is determining who becomes the candidates. And then money is determining who wins the elections. And I know of one person, I actually met an individual here at Holden Village a number of years ago. He later ran for the Minnesota legislature in a rural district, and we have relatively small districts, and we have some of the better campaign finance limits in the country. He's limited as a state representative to spending, I think it's about $24,000 in a campaign. And he ran an unsuccessful race one time, then a couple years later he was running for a state house seat in the race that his party held in the past and was expected to retain. And he ran a good campaign, hardworking guy, and his opponent didn't do that much until the last 3 weeks. There were radio ads in Twin Cities, WCCO radio, in the race, in races like that. There were postcards, flyers going to every house. There were two or three groups that put in a ton of money. Two of the groups were issue advocacy. They didn't say vote for or vote against, so they weren't even classified as independent expenditures. So we as a public have no way of knowing who funded them, who they are, what they stand for other than their name. One was Coalition for Our Children's Future from Falls Church, Virginia. They had these glossy postcards saying how so-and-so was really good on these things and this guy was really bad on them. Didn't say vote against him or vote for the other guy. You couldn't get any impression other than vote for or against him. Anyway, this candidate, we sort of tried to figure out how much was spent against him in the last 3 weeks, and he figured that these three groups alone spent probably $40,000-$50,000, more than double he was allowed to spend all year. He had no clue this was coming, no way of knowing it was coming, no way to respond to it. He happened to win in a three-way race with by about 0.5% with 45% of the vote. And so he won, so it proves money doesn't always talk. Well, another district, somebody else hit by the same three organizations working, did get beat by a very close margin. And it doesn't take a lot of votes in a lot of districts to make a difference in who controls the political process. And that's the part that determines who gets elected. And I would argue it also determines what issues they may choose to focus on. I think that if you look at issues, somebody last night at the forum raised the issue of affordable health care. I think if you take polls of the public, I've seen some polls, I don't have any with me today to show exactly what it is, but the public saying that they think what I sort of sense was an unwritten and never quite fulfilled social compact that was started in New Deal days about how, you know, you work 40 hours a week, that's full-time work, and you're going to have your retirement set aside for with Social Security. And though it took 40 more years, 20, 30 more years to get health care for retirement, health care for all Americans has never quite been fulfilled. And I think if you ask polls, do you think someone who's working full-time should be able to go see a doctor when they need, should get medical care they need, and they shouldn't be turned away because they don't have money? I think polls usually suggest 60%+ of the public says yes, that is a priority for them. But anybody talking universal health care in state or national elections is considered, that's considered a fringe issue. Why? Because there's nobody funding that sort of thing. There are lots of pressures in the political process funding other things. That doesn't mean they're going to attack the person for, this person believes everybody should have health care, and they want to, if they do, it'll be, they want government-run health care, government mucking around in your health care kind of ads. But there are lots of groups that will attack them just on other issues, wherever they think they're most vulnerable. Why? Because they want to get rid of those people from the political process. So certain issues don't ever quite come to light. People think, boy, everybody I talk to wants, cares about this. Why don't politicians talk about that? Well, it's because the money process talks about who's going to run and what issues they may talk about. The other area where money has an impact is access to politicians after they are elected in office. And they do that two ways. One is through gifts and contributions after they're elected. And the other is just the fact that they already have gained the access from the contributions they made in order to help somebody get elected. You know, when I was first running for office, I wasn't expected to win, and I abided by our voluntary spending limits. They are, by the courts, required to be voluntary. I ran for office, accepted our spending limits, which 12 years ago were about, I think, around $37,000 or so. I spent probably $36,500 of it, and my opponent chose not to abide by the limits, for which he lost several thousand dollars in public money. That was the only consequence. And he spent $55,000 or so, and he knew he was going to win. I pulled off an upset. I outworked him, did several other things right, and I beat him. 3-4 days after I was elected, I started getting all of these nice congratulatory letters, and so I got one from a lobbyist who said, "Dear John, congratulations on your election." I mean, I can recite this 12 years later, almost verbatim, because I saved the letter. It was such a gem. "Congratulations on your election. You showed hard work really does make a difference. One of my clients had the," he named who they were, "had the misfortune of having contributed to your opponent. Here is a contribution to you as they wish to make amends." I saved the letter. Well, what was the misfortune? Did these people not think that this, didn't they give to this guy because they thought he was the best guy for the state or even the best guy for their particular industry? Well, probably not. They gave to him because he was supposed to win. And they goofed. So now they're trying to make amends. Why should they make amends? Because I'm the one who votes on the issue that they care very deeply about, and therefore they want to be on my good side too. And so they want to get access. That's a contribution after an election to try and do it. But Jesse Ventura, our governor, had run saying he wouldn't take PAC or lobbyist money. He did take large individual contributions, which is one of the big routes of big money. But most of the big money didn't go his way because he didn't have a chance again. And so afterwards, it was amazing how many tried to fund things like his inaugural fund in other ways. They were eager to contribute to those things, and lobbyists were in a tizzy. How do we quickly get access to this guy now? We didn't give money to him. And I don't mean to suggest that everybody works solely. So there are lots of lobbyists who don't even make campaign contributions. That's not the way everything works, but it's clearly tilted that way in many ways. And again, it's not a buying of votes, but you know, if somebody gives you $1,000, you might be, one U.S. senator said a couple years ago, you come home at 11:30 at night, and you got a call back to your home, you got a list of calls from your home state, and an hour or two later there, and you know you can return one or two of them. Which ones are you going to do? Well, if there's a big contributor in there, human nature is you will probably include that one on your call list. It certainly moves up the call list when somebody's done something for you. It's being polite. It's being a good human being. Yes, Spector.
You know, while you're saying that, though, it reminds me of a lobbyist, one lobbyist that I knew of. And there's a little bit more to it with this guy. He was supposedly one of the best lobbyists in the legislature. One reason was because he represented a lot of well-funded PACs, and so he could give money. But beyond that, he was very well-versed in his material, and he could make very persuasive arguments. No politician, I think, wants to believe that they don't have integrity, wants to believe that they would just, you know, let you know, vote for someone or support them because they gave them money. So if they have the access and then the person gives them lots of good reasons to vote a certain way, then they can rationalize that they've changed their minds or something.
Right.
And that's why this guy was so effective. It wasn't
and you know, some of the best funded lobbyists are some of the worst ones with the information. There are lots of ways somebody can have influence, one of which is persuasiveness, another one of which is just hammering somebody home with political pressure from having thousands of people call and write and to back up their position. Another one is certainly the being your friend, professional friend. And I carried a bill several years ago that banned gifts from lobbyists and interest groups to public officials in Minnesota, which is described, I've heard it said many times in places where city halls and so on, where it's been described as that expletive deleted Marty law. They don't like it. It works. One of the lobbyists in Minnesota, and again, I said many lobbyists don't make any campaign contributions, but one of the lobbyists in Minnesota spent $120,000+ in the 2-year period before that gift ban law took effect on buying things for lawmakers, usually food, some tickets to sporting events, not large amounts at any one occasion. He wasn't giving $10,000 in cash to somebody, but you buy them dinner, matter of fact, the guy delivered pastries, usually bagels, to some offices of powerful committee chairs and so on, such a regular basis. One intern apparently asked a staff person that I know a couple years ago, who is that guy, who's that caterer who always brings in those bagels? It's not a caterer, he's a lobbyist. And yes, it's not only that, as you point out. I don't want to think of myself as crooked. I don't think any of my colleagues do. And frankly, 90-some% of them are not. They're honorable people. You'd be proud to have them as your friends and neighbors. And for good reason, they're honorable people. But again, why do they do this? Because they become your friend. They have the access to you. And that may not make you turn around from an issue where you disagree with them. It may make you make one less speech in opposition to it. It may make you a little less aggressive about offering an amendment to counter what they're doing. And if you're really, truly kind of 50-50, and a lot of issues are, six of one, half dozen the other, you're weighing and you're agonizing which way it goes, you probably listen a little bit more to the people who talk to you. And who talks to you are the ones who hang around and get the access, and that's one of the things that money can do to help do it. So I suggest that in addition to money influencing who gets elected and how they get elected, and who runs even, it also has an impact once you are elected and what you do and how you behave there.
What's the likelihood of, rather naive comment maybe, but what's the likelihood of somebody accepting the gifts with the idea that in their noble way are going to use that funding to take care of things in the way they see fit without being influenced?
Again, I think I would suggest that most members of the legislature of both parties in our state, most politicians on any city council, most members of U.S. Congress would see that's what they're doing. They fully intend to be that way. They don't want to. As a matter of fact, they'd be offended if you suggest that they are. When I offered the gift ban law the first couple of times, the first time I had a hearing on it, are you suggesting I can be bought for a lunch? And maybe if you're making such a big stink about this, maybe you're just feeling guilty about it, and maybe you should just deal with yourself rather than this. And if you don't want to be accusatory in trying to do it, you can't. It's only so much you can do without being accusatory. Anyhow, I'll get to quickly a solution that I think the obvious solution to me is to take the money out of the process, and I'd suggest all of the money out of it. And the reason for that is I think money in politics seems to work as sort of a balloon. You squeeze it in one place and it pops out some other place. I've authored several bills on campaign finance reform. They started out as comprehensive things. They got whittled down from what I was hoping to do, but we've done quite a bit to clamp down. But then you find out it tries to squeeze out some other area that got deleted from the proposal or something else, and it pops out somewhere else. So you can't say, well, we get rid of some of it. And there are lots of proposals, and you can usually tell which party they are that is offering them by what they go after. Republicans tend to go after banning PAC money. Democrats tend to go after banning larger contributions. I'd suggest you say that you ban this type. PAC, political action committees, which are the things where a group in most states, it's a 30-year-old phenomenon since federal campaign finance reform, said that instead of allowing corporate contributions, instead of allowing other types of things, we'll let nonprofit campaign-type organizations collect money from people. They have to report it. They can take any amount of money from anybody they want, and then they can give. In Minnesota, they can give as much as an individual can give, and federal law, I think they can give 5 times what an individual can give. labor unions have them, various issue advocacy groups have them, trade associations have them, all sorts of people have them. And so banning those things, I'd say, would be a plus. But if you do that and you don't ban the large individual contributions, then the groups that want to do it, they channel their money that way. The lobbyist money, I think we should be saying somebody who wants to be a registered, paid lobbyist to state government should be banned from giving money to the people they're trying to influence. Soft money, gifts. I think we ought to be looking at trying to find a way to get all of this up. But there are obstacles. The courts. And number two is difficulty of getting these things through a legislature, U.S. Congress, or a place where they've often had the most success has been in states that have voter initiatives on them. The courts, they say equal protection is not a factor. The idea that we all have a right to be heard in our democracy, you have a right to go out there in the woods and yell your positions on any issue, and if you happen to have a whole truckload of money, you can buy TV ads that'll hit the Seattle market day after day after day after day after day, and slowly but surely change public opinion on who to vote for or support for something or against something. And you can say, well, I have an equal right to be heard. I have a free speech right too. And the courts have said, well, yes, you have a free speech right to all the free speech you can afford. Free, obviously, not meaning financially free. You're allowed to say whatever you want as long as you can afford to be heard, you can be heard. And they have said equal protection does not win out. Again, in the criminal justice system, for the last 30 years now, we've said, you know, you have a right, the Constitution has always said you've got a right to legal counsel in cases where you're being you've been accused of a crime. You have legal counsel, right? And if you can't afford it, since the mid-60s, we haven't said tough. We've said we will provide you legal counsel. It is a constitutional guarantee that you have legal counsel. If you can't afford it, we'll get it to you. We don't have the same thing for political free speech. We say that's our number one. It's our First Amendment. It's our number one highest priority in our democracy, but you don't have the right to get your free speech if you can't afford it. So there is equal protection, the courts have said, doesn't have an impact. They have said if we can show corruption, which I think we can and have done some of, it can have an impact on it. And I agree with the court on the importance of the First Amendment. I don't think they're misreading the Constitution on that. I think they're misreading the reality of what's happening in the political world. The court said the First Amendment, and this is a 1976 case, the big one that tilted how future decisions have gone on campaign financing. They said the First Amendment was, quote, designed to secure the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources and to assure the unfettered interchange of ideas for bringing about political and social changes desired by the people. And as I pointed out earlier, I think the opposite of that is happening because of the money, because of the way the process is tilted. Many points of view, many candidates don't even run. The other countries with parliamentary systems have 20 parties and people from every kind of extreme running for this. In ours, you happen to have various perspectives on social issues, on economic issues, on other types of issues running for office. But it's not a full spectrum of things, and certain positions are very much not heard in the process. And as I mentioned, how many of the candidates for president are being dropped out, not because they're not the most thoughtful people or whatever, but because they can't raise the money. The things I would suggest, the solutions to the court obstacles are, one is we've got to do a better job of providing documentation to the courts of the corruption. And number two, of the harm to the First Amendment's purpose of providing an unfettered interchange of ideas, because it's clearly I agree with them. That's what the First Amendment says. That's what the goal of it is. And they're saying, because of the First Amendment, we have to say that the more speech you can afford to get, matter of fact, they have argued, the solution is not to clamp down on some people. The solution is to encourage others to get as much money as they can to do it. They'll even allow public funding of campaigns so poor candidates can get some more money. But frankly, dumping 10 times as much money into the process doesn't make more views be heard. It just suffocates everybody in disgusting TV ads, usually. But the second solution is, I think there are creative legislative proposals that can address the court's concerns. In Minnesota, we've worked around the idea of voluntary campaign spending limits tied with public funding and freeing you from those limits if your opponent skips them. And they've had a real significant impact on it. And the third option is the constitutional amendment, but that's a very, very difficult thing to do, and I don't know how you'd word the amendment. But those are ways you can address the court's thing. I don't think it should be an insurmountable obstacle. The solutions to the difficulty in passing the law, one is, I think you have to work on designing a fair system, one that's not tilted towards either party. The other party in our state has often offered amendments banning contributions from PACs and lobbyists, and at the same time pushing for larger individual contributions to be allowed. My party hates that because they feel they suffer most from the individual contributions, not the other ones. I think you have to have a balanced approach. And unfortunately, when you argue for a balanced approach, they usually say, well, then if so-and-so groups can give PAC money, then we ought to allow corporate contributions as well. And their goal is to open up more money again. And they keep saying how the $1,000 campaign contribution limit at the federal level is too low. Talk in congressional circles is that it hasn't been changed in good number of years now. It's way too low. We should up it so people should be able to give much more. But design a fair system that's not tilted towards one party, and I'd say the more you can just be a comprehensive approach that says no to that money and replaces it with, frankly, public financing. And boy, that goes over like a lead balloon, usually in public polls. Not always, if you explain it and so on. States have passed referenda many times in the last couple of years that provide large amounts of public money. And that means people are voting to give their tax dollars to candidates that they oppose. But they do it because it's part of a system that's cleaning out. They call them, a lot of those referendums, they've called them clean money campaigns by taking out all the private money and replacing it with the public money. And the second thing I think you can do is you can build public outrage over the current system to the point that it makes a difference. In Wisconsin, the U.S. Senator there decided he was going to run a campaign on his support of, well, actually, the one half of the McCain-Feingold. McCain is a U.S. Senator from Arizona who is also running for president, Republican candidate who is struggling because of a lack of money, of all things. In Wisconsin, Russ Feingold, his Democratic counterpart, who was the other author of the McCain-Feingold bill, he ran for re-election Senate last year, refusing to setting several things. Three-quarters of his money had to come in state. He was going to spend no more than, I think it was like a dollar per voter. He had all these limits he put on himself, and when the Democratic Party came in with these soft money issue ads to help him out, he stopped them from running them. He argued and begged them not to do so, and they cut him. And campaign finance reform proponents have said, well, he won. He just barely squeaked by after having a lead several months earlier of 20% or so. So it's not a ringing endorsement of it, but you got to get public outrage. I know that I chair the committee that deals with these issues in the Minnesota Senate. And I know the first time I tried a campaign finance reform bill, that bill had more hearings than any bill in Minnesota state history. You get a complex health care bill and it might have to go to the tax committee, the commerce committee, the health care committee, three or four committees, and they may each have two or three hearings. You might have a really complex bill, maybe 10 or 12 hearings. Well, in 93, when I brought up this campaign finance bill, I started hearing it the first week of the session. My committee meets twice a week. So we had two, four, six. We'd slip in a couple of bills once in a while because they had to keep going. We weren't almost done with the big one. we went past our first committee deadline and the House passed a weaker bill. And why did it take so long? They didn't want to pass the bill. And every time they were about to vote to delete something else, the reporters were playing sort of cat and mouse game. They'd be listening on the speakers from our hearing room and they'd come up from their press room every time there was about to be a vote. And all of a sudden all these votes to take out provisions would, the amendment would just be defeated as soon as the reporters came in the room. Reporters would go back downstairs and they'd start on with another amendment like that. It went on for about 3 or 4 months, and again, it had more hearings in one committee than any other bill in state history, I'll guarantee it. But it is needs the public attention, the public outrage to get it going. Then finally, one more thing before I open it up for discussion on this. I think despite all of what I've said here, a lot of public officials will still say money doesn't have an impact on the process. Lobbyists at the Capitol will say, no, they don't give money because it does. But I wanted to give a couple more examples of things that were really striking, one of which came from the tobacco industry documents that were released under Minnesota's lawsuit last year. I've gone over there a couple of times. It's really amazing some of the things they've said in private, if you take the time to dig for them. Internal memo from the Tobacco Institute, their lobbying arm, their chief lobbying group, give us all, including my colleagues, politicians, a rare look at what lobbyists will say in private. Here's a quote from one. Our lobbying team is considered in almost every circle to be the most effective and most respected lobbying team in the state of Minnesota. Their access to legislative offices is unparalleled. Their system of political influence is second to none. In the very next sentence, the memo uses evidence of that lobbying firm's campaign contributions as proof of their cover. Quote, as a matter of fact, our lobbyists have in their own firm a registered political action committee which contributes over $50,000 annually to legislative races and constitutional races. They're using the internal memo to the bosses of the Tobacco Institute are saying, we've got the best firm. They've got this. They talk about their lobbyists having a firm grip on legislators, certain legislators. And how do they prove it? Look at the size of their political action committee. It is big. Then the other things in the tobacco memos, one of my colleagues, the committee chair, they brag in there about how hard he's been working to deny a hearing on a bill that they don't want. He's helped us about as long as he can now, though it's getting embarrassing, so he's soon gonna have to give a hearing on the bill. Then our governor, an internal memo with his private penned in notes to his attorney. I mean, you know how tightly people keep those internal memos between a governor and the governor's attorney confidential. I'll guarantee you nobody in the public has any access to that. Well, how did I see it? Came out in the Philip Morse files. Came out there, somebody sent somebody, either in the governor's office, I'll guess his attorney didn't on her own accord send it off to them. I'll guess governor said, send a copy of this over to so-and-so at company. Same company that a year earlier had provided the governor an all-expense-paid trip to Australia with for him and his spouse. And I told you earlier about the letter I got, the misfortune of contributing to your opponent. And then one final example, I've been spending a lot of time on stadium issues, fighting against public financing of them, and the owner of the Minnesota Twins, who's been asking state for about 3 or 4 years now for a publicly financed stadium. There's an article, it was an issue I tried to raise to get the Capitol reporters interested in proving what was happening in 1996. They were keeping it quiet till after the election, then they were gonna push ahead for it. And the documentation I used to show what was going on was all the campaign contributions all their lobbyists were making. Capitol Press Corps, this is boring, this happens all the time, what's so new about that? Well, a sports reporter for the Minneapolis paper kind of got wind of this and started looking at it further, and he wrote a big front page story, not sports page, but front page of the Metro section. Polads spread their wealth around, and he asked them, why are they giving so much money now? And their lobbyists said, well, we've never had an issue this big before the legislature before. And they asked, one of the POAD, the owner's sons. Well, how come you guys are giving to both parties? Not just candidates, but again, both political parties. The Democratic Party campaign funds and the Republican Party ones. He said it was a bipartisan sort of thing, which is by both parties. And I'll guarantee you, nobody, I don't think you could find a single one of Minnesota's 4¾ million citizens giving money to both political parties at the same time, except for those who are lobbyists or those who are interests that have some big issue before the legislature. And to me, that's pretty conclusive why they do it. I think, other than them saying, we're making these contributions in order to gain access and to get a more favorable hearing, which they'll actually admit at times, that's the closest you're ever going to get to ironclad proof of the impact of money in politics, and I think it has to be changed. Anyway, I started late, and I think we still have about, what time is it now?
22.
Because we still have a few more minutes, so questions, comments, response, whatever. Yes, against the window.
It is now August of 1999. It seemed like the presidential election started way back in March and April, and the election isn't way until next year in November. In regard to campaign reform and finances, don't you think if they started things a little bit later, they wouldn't necessarily need all this extra money? And, you know, we are going to be so tired by November of 2000, you know? What's your spin on that? Am I seeing things?
No, you're seeing it exactly right. The difficulty is, how do you do that? In a lot of countries, they have limited campaigns to 3 months. Unfortunately, we have, or it's 3 weeks. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, where we have a late primary, it's the second Tuesday after the first Monday in September. There's a big push this year, both the Democratic and Republican parties, I think official positions supporting an earlier primary. It's, it won't lengthen the campaign season, we'll just move it to June. Instead of 7 weeks, which our 98 election, general election campaign was, they'd have 22 weeks. I thought, what do you mean, that's not lengthening the campaign? The previous governor was asking for that. The current governor says he'll veto that if it passes, and we were able to kill it off partly for that reason. But I think you're right. I think the public pays a lot more attention. I don't think if you have a 2-week campaign, that may be enough. I think though 3 months or something of a general election, 3 months of everything before would be ideal. I ran for governor 5 years ago and started informally started in June of 93 and formally kicked off a campaign in November, and a year out. But realistically, from the exploratory thing on, I was campaigning. That was 17 months of campaign, and that was way too long, and I was one of the last ones in the race. One of my opponents kept saying, oh, one of the ones I beat for the party nomination in the primary. One of them said, well, because I started months after Marty did. Well, he was going to candidate forums months before I even started thinking about running. And they all try and do it. This past time, we had candidates running 3 years out for governor. And as I told a couple of people after last night's forum, in 1952, the first time Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson faced off for U.S. president, it was at Chicago Historical Society about a year ago, and there was a great exhibit on national party conventions. And Adlai Stevenson, there was a letter in there from a couple of Chicago business people urging Adlai Stevenson to get in the race and saying they were going to form a draft Stevenson committee, which they did, 9 months before the presidential campaign, they started a draft committee. They talked him into running a couple months later. Now we have 4 years out is nothing out of the ordinary for that. I'm not sure how you change that, though. I'd welcome suggestions for it. The one thing I know is don't keep moving elections further back. I think the trouble is if you just say, oh, you can't do it, well, they're out there raising money, and you can't constitutionally stop them from trying to raise money and so on. So they build up this big war chest, and somebody who's not organizing ahead of time is at a big disadvantage. I think keeping the timelines tight will help to save some of the money, bring down some of the costs, but If you have any suggestions, anybody, I'd welcome that kind of thing, because we need to change that. Other, yes, over here.
Well, at one time, we needed that time to get a grassroots organization built to do the campaigning when the campaigning started.
Right.
The Goldwater campaign started immediately after the election four years before. But it's only to build a grassroots group.
But again, the grassroots building nowadays often tends to mean raising money.
That's right.
And building those things. And I would love to see, I mean, I really do think people pay more attention when it's short and quick, when it's building up for years and years, than you get to the time when the newspapers and everybody start running profiles of where everybody stands on the issues. The public's already turned off its antenna because it's so sick of the ads and everything else.
And they basically, you know, it's already out. They basically told you who they think is going to win anyway. So what's really the point?
The polls, yeah.
That develops an apathetic crowd, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think the point, it's not, they don't really ads so much now. Their main point is fundraising. And if you get somebody like George Bush, who has this huge, you know, money begets money, if somebody looks like a really credible candidate because they've already raised lots of money, then more people are going to contribute to them because they want to.
Which,
and so at this point, way early out, I think the point is much more fundraising than.
Which
know,
is why, which is why if you can't stop the issue of they can't shorten the length of the campaigns that way, I think the one thing to do, and again, Bush, the reason he's needed so much money is now he can avoid the spending limits. He doesn't have to abide by them, and so anybody else running against him in this whole process isn't going to be tied down with some spending limits. And I think that argues, again, why we need to have some spending limits in the races and contribution limits and public financing. Why don't we have any public financing whatsoever in our U.S. Congress? I think that's the biggest political scandal in our country, is our lack of public financing and lack of spending limits and lack of contribution limits, in which people buy votes for their interest. Any last question? Because I think we're pretty close to the time.
One of the worst examples I can think of buying influence is Keating a few years back. And if I can only remember one senator, but it seems to me he bought, he had senators
five
from both parties.
Were,
five.
Was,
you know, and boy, they really jumped, you know. Mm-hmm. They weren't very pleased about it.
Well, the thing is, in the Keating scandal, which I can't even remember all of the folks involved anymore, and it's been long and most of them got out of politics, but a lot of them, I mean, I think they felt, you know, when a constituent comes to me and says, you know, I want your help with this federal agency doing this, you know, a lot of legislators, a lot of them may have done the same thing for him anyway, but he was giving large money, and clearly he was quoted as saying, when somebody asked him, do you think all your contributions made a difference? He said, they sure better have.
Yeah.
Again, it's the same thing as these tobacco lobbyist people, what they say internally. Well, of course it's going to have an impact. It better have one. And it happens way too often. And it's, I mean, interest groups. Bob Dole last year, I don't know if I mentioned this last night, but there it came out in the 96 presidential race, right before he left the U.S. Senate to campaign, he fought against, he was one of a handful of senators fighting against the federal giveaway, government giveaway of the digital broadcast spectrum, the new part of the airwaves that we're giving to networks. Estimates were that we could auction that federal property, that public access, public airwaves, for as much as $70 billion. Did you see any stories of that on the TV news?
Yeah.
None. You couldn't. They didn't like that issue coming up. And Dole has a letter. I've seen it quoted, what it said, from a TV station owner who owns several stations in Kansas, his home state, several stations in Iowa where the first caucuses are, telling him that if he didn't back off of his position, they were going to get him. I mean, how blatant can you be? And yet, of course, they get away with it. And You know, I was not a big Dole fan. I'm not a big Dole fan, but did he get fair treatment in the presidential campaign from the TV media? I don't know. Bill Moyers, again, he said, you know, when one broadcaster who was attacking some of the corporate interests who owned the radio stations that this guy was on got pulled off the airwaves. Weeks after Disney bought up ABC Radio, which carried this guy's show. And ABC said, well, we pulled him because his ratings weren't high enough. Bill Moyers' comment was, we'll never know. We can't know. We just know that somebody who's critical of their concerns, they got the money, they can.
Story is the ecological campaigning, like the chicken farms and the hog farms down in the Carolinas. So forth.
Did you see that Bill Moyers show on that one? One woman, a state representative there, and if there's anything like Minnesota or Washington State's state representative candidate are probably going to be spending maybe in some states $50,000 to $100,000, most states a fraction of that. And this Republican state representative in North Carolina was taking on the big hog feedlots because she saw they were turning her lakes, the rivers down there into sewers, and poisoning people. And she spoke out against it, and they formed a group called Farmers for Fairness, which did issue advocacy. Again, they were not a PAC. They did independent expenditures, telling people, you should ask her why she's so dishonest about this state representative. Why is she this? Why is she this? And Bill Moyers tried to track down based on TV airtime and so on. She concluded they spent over $2 million in a primary to defeat her just on the TV ads. When she probably spent, all from this one group.
Why, that's right.
And
it was her own party, too.
What?
It was her own party.
It was her own party's people who did it.
She's a Republican.
Yeah, it was her own party's people who did it because she spoke out on that issue. I mean, it's nothing short of buying elections, and the democracy is too important for that.
Well, Tyson got special treatment, though, on his chicken operations on inspections because of his contributions to the, he got it through the committee man out of the party.
Well, I just to close, I was going to say, I think we all understand that this thing happens. I think it is a thing we can address. I think we have to address it if we care about the future of democracy. There's no other issue that's going to corrode our democracy more than this. It affects, as I said at the beginning, people's willingness to participate. And the solution is not to say, oh, it's a hopeless cause and give up. The solution is to get angry and try and do something about it. And there are groups like Common Cause and League of Women Voters and others that do speak out on it. And I think we have to work together to make the change because democracy is worth it. And with that, we'll close it. I'll be around to take informal discussion later. But thank you very much for your attendance.